If there is nothing so lovely as a tree, in a city there aren't many things that can be as destructive, and summer storms can bring out the killer instinct. It's a painful reality for people who live in cities known for their tree canopies. Washington, D.C. is one. There, NPR's Larry Abramson asks, can city residents coexist with the trees they love?
This is Barnaby Woods, my neighborhood for nearly 20 years. I can still remember the first time my wife and I got out of the car here. We craned our necks and marveled at the huge oaks and maples overhead. They stretch from one side of the street and touch the trees on the other side. At least they used to.
I'm amazed at the fact that you lost these trees over this last few years. I mean, really, it's sort of like just very bad luck.
Local arborist Keith Pitchford remembers how my street used to look. 3 years ago, he helped my neighbors and me save some of those trees from the hands of Pepco. The local power company wanted to cut down a dozen bad actors, trees that kept rubbing up against power lines, causing regular blackouts. We won that battle, but we lost the war.
We're looking at the end of sort of a climax forest age, where the bigger trees are starting to die and fall, and the younger trees are coming up.
In the past few years, storms, old age, and disease have killed many of the giants. One came down this past June and took out power for 3 days. Keith Pitchford says the titans that were planted here 80 years ago have had it.
I think you had mostly northern red oaks or scarlet oaks along here, yeah.
Oh, it hurts to hear him talk about my trees in the past tense. But the signs are undeniable. The shade garden we planted years ago is getting burnt to a crisp as the shade givers bite the dust. Earlier this summer, a particularly macho storm tore through town and took out this gorgeous silver maple in the Georgetown section of D.C. It looks like some arboreal traffic accident. This majestic tree lies splayed across an entire intersection. On the way down, it dealt a fatal blow to two of its brethren. The other trees are still standing, but D.C. arborist John Thomas says they will have to be put down.
Once a tree of this size, a 40-inch tree or a mature tree, gets damaged to this level, it'll be unstable. It'll produce vegetative growth that's not structurally sound. The best thing is to get it out and get it replanted and get the new tree going.
And then I'd just be curious about replanting.
Yeah,
and
we'll
when
automatically
we can get
go back on the list in this fall.
Will it? So you think it'll happen this fall?
Oh, yeah.
Susie Kupka, a neighbor, asked Thomas how long it will take to replace this tree. She is clearly sad at the loss, but other residents also get hopping mad when they lose power for days. They ask, why weren't these trees removed earlier? John Thomas says you have to pick your priorities.
I think it's what do we want to live with as a society? Are we willing to lose power and lose stuff in our refrigerator and sitting with candles? But do we want a canopy out in front of our house and along our sidewalks?
The big trees of Washington are a big problem for Nathan McElroy, a forester for local power supplier Pepco.
The trees are so big, there's no room to move the wires, and they're burning. They're coming in direct contact with these huge trees.
McElroy is out at a work site on the edge of the city. There was no storm here. This is preventive maintenance. McElroy is supervising a contractor who is delicately pruning some scarlet and willow oaks.
We're trying to prevent leaders from establishing themselves through the phases, through the energized conductors.
In arborees, that means McElroy is trying to train the tree to stay away from the power lines. When wire meets tree, the results can be spectacular.
You could see it was burning very gradually over many years.
McElroy holds up a charred branch from a tree that got too big for its britches. I've seen where this can lead. Twice, the big tree in front of my house caused the power line to snap. A live wire danced on my front lawn for many uncomfortable minutes, spewing sparks like a fire hose. The thing was so hot, it turned soil into glass. That's why Pepco and other power companies are so passionate about trimming trees often and taking down those that get out of hand. Spokesman Clay Anderson.
We do not look at the tree as something that is we're trying to harm. Safety is a prime concern.
There was a time when I would have rolled my eyes at that statement. Back in 2005, Pepco crews planned to give my neighborhood trees a crew cut without even telling the residents. I saw the utility people as brutes who just wanted to save themselves the trouble of dealing with downed trees after storms. My neighbors and I got the utility to X-ray some trees. Many turned out to be healthy and were spared. But as trees continue to die, it's clear we need a long-term solution to the collision between trees and power lines. Some arborists say there is an answer.
Planting the proper tree in this space, like for instance the amber maple that we installed in front of your house.
Earl Utzler is an arborist for the City of Washington. He helped pick some replacement trees after the battle on Barnaby Street. Proper tree, proper place is the motto for the city's plan to replace tall trees under power lines with species that are more cooperative.
Here's a good example of these are purple leaf plums that were planted along where elms have been removed.
Earl Utzler takes me for a drive in his little natural gas-powered car down a Washington street. He points to a strip of perfectly respectable trees that will never cause any problems for the power company.
They're starting to establish themselves. You know, these here that are already, say, 15 feet are going to get another 10 feet tall, and that's going to be it.
They're not really providing shade in the sense that, you know, you can go out and sit with your neighbors on the street under a tree like that. It's just not the same experience.
You're entirely right. It is different, but it's more manageable. It's less dangerous.
City foresters encourage residents who want tall trees to plant them closer to houses and away from the power lines. But small city lots mean you may have to plant uncomfortably close to home. Many cities are moving in the direction of shorter trees under power lines. Phoenix, for example, recently inventoried 17,000 trees. 12,000 were found to be problem species threatening the electric grid. They will be gradually replaced with the right tree in the right space. Back on Barnaby Street, arborist Keith Pitchford says new communities can learn from all of this. They can plan ahead and avoid these conflicts. But it's a lot harder for older, established neighborhoods like mine.
And everyone wants to put the power lines underground or something, but, you know, if they buried them underground, they'd be cutting all the roots of the trees we're trying to preserve because they'd want to put them under the sidewalk. Ultimately, we're going to have to live with smaller canopied trees under the power lines and bigger trees on the other side of the road.
Pitchford says he wishes it weren't so. Me, I can't help myself. Sometimes I go up to the puny amber maple, which the city planted in place of a huge oak, and I whisper to that tree, "Think big." Larry Abramson, NPR News.
It's not that easy being green, having to spend each day the color.
And now for a story about salmon and a biologist who loves them. She studied their anatomy, their courtship rituals, even their afterlife as nutrients for trees. Her greatest passion is taking their portraits underwater in the remote rivers of the Pacific Northwest. NPR senior correspondent Ketzel Levine has this profile of the floating photographer.
She's an artist, a fish biologist, a cold water dry suit junkie, but she is no fool. When Mary Edwards heads into the Oregon wilderness for a day alone on the river, she always lets someone know.
Hey, Jeff, Mayor, listen, you're my call out today. You don't hear back from me by 6 o'clock tonight? Yeah, the posse. Okay, bye.
We're eating dust for breakfast as we drive into the Wallowa Mountains, heading for the Lostine River. The two of us are dressed like matching turtles in our waterproof drab greens. Mary Edwards grabs her gear.
Okay.
We waddle through brush and she yells, "Hey, bear! Hey, bear!" I listen to the rhythm but am deaf to the meaning of her words.
Okay, putting the gloves on.
The sun skips along the water as we wade in for the first breathless moment of the day as Mary Edwards lowers her camera into the rushing river and prays its waterproof casing holds.
It's $3,000. And we look good.
No bubbles, no nothing.
No bubbles, no nothing. Oh, boy, that water's cold.
Come on, I want to see you get in there already.
Let me get my mask.
Ah, too much prep. Let's go. We've got a robin's egg blue sky cut by mountains and conifers on this pinch-me-I-must-be-dreaming morning with the proverbial cinematic river running through it, all part of the alchemy now about to take place as a research biologist sheds all professional detachment to lose herself in cold water wonder.
Okay, I'm going in.
The current's pretty swift, but she's holding on to some large stones to keep herself anchored. She's just showed me how big they are. They're pretty tiny.
Little fish. They're Chinook salmon. Big school little fish. I want to see if there's more fish up around the bend.
Mary Edwards lives pretty close to here in Joseph, Oregon, where she works for the Nez Perce Fisheries. But I'm with a very different woman now, an artist who toys with the truth, who will use computer tools to tinker with today's underwater images, often pushing her photos to watercolor-like extremes.
You know, there are some images that I'll look at, and they're beautiful in and of themselves, just as is. And I don't need to add to it. There are other images that are beautiful, and I don't know, it's like I want to change it. Maybe accent a particular energy that's in the image.
And this is the place to be for energy. It's salmon spawn time. Those few magical weeks every year when salmon complete their impossible journey, traveling in this case from an ocean 650 miles east to the very gravel where they were born. And there they nest in what's called a red.
So right on the far bank over there is a red. In fact, there's a fish on. There's a fish on. Oh, wow, that's hot. There's two. Can you see them?
As never before, a pair of courting Chinook salmon.
That's digging. See how it flips on its side and does that motion with the tail? And working up to what I love to call the moment, and that's when she'll actually let her eggs out, and he'll express milt at the same time.
She won't be shooting the moment. She'd never risk interfering. And since this could take hours, even days, we leave the couple in peace and head to another promising pool. Okay, this is great. I just came out of the water to grab the machine because Mary just spied a huge salmon. She really wanted to shoot big salmon today, so this could be it. What do you think?
Well, I don't know sex, but it was a Chinook salmon.
How big?
Large.
3 feet long and about 4 years old.
He's starting to look a little beat up. He's probably fighting with other males. Towards the end of spawn, they look terrible.
Left holding the microphone as she descends once more, I take a deep breath and a long view of the wilderness around us. And then it comes to me, unbidden, but clear as a bell. Hey, bear! Hey, bear! We are in bear country during happy hour. Is this worth it? Mary resurfaces, and I've got my answer. Passion, risk, reward.
So because his head is tucked up under the log, and I can't get a full frame, what was nice about this is that his tail was dancing out into the light. So it'll be more kind of an abstract shot. We'll see how it looks when we pull it up at home.
Later, at home, Mary Edwards will subtly manipulate the image of liquid light streaming through this Chinook's ragged tail. She'll tweak the exposure, play with the black, punch minute details. A workmanlike process that belies her own awe during a day on the river, watching the beat-up bodies of near-death salmon come home to spawn.
All my science background says, well, it's governed by all these other things, but if I could take one-tenth of that determination and apply it to my life, what would I accomplish? What would all of us accomplish?
Ketzel Levine, NPR News.
Hey, Jeffy, it's Mayor. Had a great day on the river, so we're A-OK.
To see images by the floating photographer, and they include a few bears cavorting at happy hour, you can visit npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
Thank you.
and an ambitious plan to replace diesel trucks in two of the nation's busiest ports with newer, cleaner ones got the go-ahead late yesterday from a federal judge. The ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach want to replace the old trucks starting the 1st of October, but trucking companies sued to stop the plan. Rob Schmitz of member station KQED reports.
From its inception, the Clean Trucks program has been called one of the boldest environmental plans in U.S. history. The $1.6 billion project is expected to cut air pollution in half for one of the most polluted areas of the country, the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles. The ports will mandate that the largely independent 17,000 truckers will have to replace their rigs. It's a big plan that, not surprisingly, has met with big resistance, namely a lawsuit filed by the American Trucking Association. On Monday, dozens of lawyers clutching overstuffed briefcases pushed their way out of Federal Judge Christina Snyder's chambers for a hearing on the issue. David Pettit, a lawyer for the Natural Resources Defense Council, was among them. He believes a plan will make L.A. a model for ports throughout the U.S.
I think there will be progress all over the country to clean up the air in the way that our ports here are doing.
The American Truckers Association wasn't arguing with that. It's worried the plan is a veiled attempt to unionize the truckers. And here's where things get a little bit complicated. Currently, most truckers are known as independent owner-operators. They work for smaller companies who manage their routes and shipments. But under the plan, truckers fear these smaller companies will be pushed aside in the Port of Los Angeles to make room for larger companies that will be under tighter jurisdiction of the port. This change will make it easier for unions to come in and organize the truckers. And many truckers don't like that idea. Independent trucker Miguel Correa is one of them. I make $100,000 a year, says Correa. The stocky 55-year-old leans against his idling big rig at his company's dusty lot inside the port. Oil refinery smokestacks pierce the smoggy horizon behind him. Trucking is Correa's life. He wears a thick silver chain with an outline of an 18-wheeler around his neck. Correa says he likes the Clean Trucks program, but he's not sure about joining the union. I make more here than I'd make with the union, he says, because the union would pay me per hour. Here, he says, they pay me for how many goods I can move. If I work fast, I can make a lot, he says. Not all truckers agree, though. Charles Williams would be happy for the union to organize truckers. He says it would be a step up from the $600 a week he makes.
Like now, we don't have any benefits, no dental, no medical. We don't have anything. We're just out here on our own, you know, living from paycheck to paycheck.
Just a couple of miles away in downtown Long Beach, Rosa Batres sits outside her neighborhood coffee shop. The 35-year-old mother of four recites a laundry list of health problems she says her family has due to dirty air from the nearby port.
We suffer from everything from itchy skin, dry skin, to the eyes, to the nose, to the throat constantly.
The California Air Resources Board has reported that the cancer risk in this area due to diesel exhaust is 500 times higher than what the federal government considers acceptable. The Clean Trucks program, intended to reduce this risk, is scheduled to start October 1st. For NPR News, I'm Rob Schmitz in Los Angeles.
Along the U.S. Gulf Coast, Louisiana is still reeling from Hurricane Gustav, which rolled through there last week. Gustav swept west of New Orleans and pounded the wetlands along the coastline. These marshes extend for 200 miles and protect the coast from big storms, but they're disappearing. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, a combination of bad weather and lack of money has hampered efforts to protect and restore the wetlands.
When Hurricane Gustav's big winds died and the clouds cleared, biologist Tommy Michaud showed up at a small airport in Louisiana to get his plane up in the air. It was his job to assess the damage to the wetlands, but first he had to get out of the hangar with no trucks in sight.
If you can hold on for a second, we got to push the plane out.
Michaud is a biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. He says the wetlands have taken a beating from hurricanes over the past 10 years. George, Lily, Isidore, Ivan, Katrina, and Rita, and now Gustav.
They blow so hard that it just kind of pushes the marsh around, especially fresh marsh that's what we call flottant marsh. It's floating on the surface. and it'll a lot of times it'll push it up in a pile and buckle it or flip it over or carry it to another place and put it down and consequently open up some big ponds or open water areas.
Open water makes wetlands more vulnerable to the next storm and less effective as a buffer against big waves and flooding. Michaud says what he's seen of Gustav's damage isn't too bad, but the effects add up.
These wetlands withstood hurricanes for hundreds of years, and they're used to that, you know, and they are resilient. They will come back. But if hurricane frequency increases, then definitely they'll keep getting them knocked back.
Even before Katrina hit 3 years ago, conservationists were trying, largely in vain, to preserve the wetlands. For decades, they'd been drained and paved or removed to make way for housing, shipping channels, or pipelines. And the only way to grow new wetlands is to add sediment. Historically, that happened when the Mississippi River flooded. Now barriers and levees prevent that. Then Katrina hit. More people realized the value of the wetlands as a sort of natural levee system to protect people, not just alligators. Conservationists crafted a multi-billion-dollar plan to restore them and went to the federal government for help. They left empty-handed.
At the end of the day, it's all about money, no matter what else you want.
King Milling is chairman of the Louisiana Governor's Advisory Committee on Coastal Protection and a longtime advocate for rebuilding the marshes. He says the federal government said, do it for less. Milling says people still underestimate the value of these wetlands.
This ecosystem is, in fact, what has preserved the lives of some 2 million people and literally hundreds of billions of dollars of infrastructure.
The marshes do that by slowing down storm surges and thus protecting things like oil and gas pipelines, refineries, chemical plants, or port facilities that serve the busy Mississippi River. Scientists from numerous universities and conservation groups have now put together a new master plan for the wetlands. The basic idea is to pump huge amounts of sediment from the Mississippi River and its delta through pipelines and into the marshes. That would create new land where plants can take root. This has been tried before at two places near New Orleans with mixed success. Scientists say those were only trial runs. Milling argues that no one knows for sure how to restore one of the world's largest wetlands. You just have to start and adapt as you go.
If we don't begin to really deal with large-scale delivery of sediment through pipelines and other conveyances by building back barrier islands, and I'm speaking 5 years now, you know, it could be too late.
Engineers have yet to dig the first spadeful of dirt for this new effort, but the state of Louisiana has put aside $500 million for it. Conservationists say each new hurricane lends more urgency to the effort. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
When Congress comes back from a break this week, one of the most immediate challenges will be restructuring Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Also a top priority, energy. We ask NPR's Debbie Elliott to tell us what's ahead in the energy debate on the Hill. You might remember one mantra heard at the National Republican Convention, drill, baby, drill.
It's the message. We heard the chants in St. Paul, and of course the drill here, drill now, is part of the Republican energy plan. We've heard it from the presidential candidate, John McCain, and we've heard it from Republican members of Congress. And in fact, we've heard it all during the August recess of Congress from Republicans. They've staged what they call an energy speak-in on the House floor.
You mean Republicans stayed in Washington to, what, get out the message?
Exactly. They're trying to get their message across that they're ready for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to call a vote on opening up the U.S. coast to offshore oil and gas development. About 130 members from the Republican Party came back and forth, taking their turn in the quiet House chamber to speak about energy and high gas prices. There were no microphones. They would just have to stand on the floor. The tourists would come down from the gallery, sit in the seats where House members normally sit and listen. So it wasn't an official session. It was a Republican speak-in, and their message was clear. Start the drill. Offshore in Alaska, tap oil shale in western states. They're also interested in promoting more nuclear power, solar and wind power, and some conservation measures. Here's Georgia Congressman Paul Brown last week promoting this Republican energy plan.
America has been drilling for ice on Mars, yet we cannot drill for oil in America. It's insane. We've been coming here for 24 days now, demanding a vote on the American Energy Act. Nancy Pelosi needs to get off her book tour and come back here and do the people's work. That's what we're doing.
And Debbie, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi initially was against offshore drilling, but she's been nudged a little more to the center because there are Democrats out there who can't afford to be against this.
Exactly. You know, polls clearly showing that a majority of Americans now favor allowing more oil and gas drilling off the U.S. coast. While some Democrats have said these Republicans are just political showboating, it's clear that Democrats have started to think about what they can do when they're back in action this week. Speaker Pelosi is now saying that she will allow a vote to what she says responsibly increase domestic supply by opening some parts of the Outer Continental Shelf to drilling. But she says with appropriate safeguards and without taxpayer subsidies to big oil. So she's certainly trying to get some of the things that Democrats want if she is going to open up some oil and gas drilling.
And Debbie, another issue that is now pending in Congress is spending. And that is not unrelated, as it turns out, to this whole debate about where the issue of energy is going.
Right. October is the new fiscal year, so Congress has to approve the spending bills to keep the government running by then. And if not, they'll have to approve continuing resolutions that would keep the government running. That's typically what has been happening in recent years and what's expected to happen in an election year. But this congressional moratorium on drilling off the Atlantic and Pacific coast and in the eastern part of the Gulf of Mexico has been in place since 1982. It has to be renewed each year as part of the bill that funds the Interior Department. So the question is whether the moratorium would be continued if they pass a continuing resolution for the Interior Department or whether it's going to be dealt with in some compromise energy legislation.
NPR's Debbie Elliott, thanks very much.
Thank you, Renee.
This hurricane season in the Atlantic is shaping up to be a busy one after two relatively quiet years. Scientists at the cutting edge of hurricane research say one reason we're seeing more storms this year may have to do with African dust. NPR's John Hamilton reports.
Big hurricanes like Gustav usually start out as small storms coming off the coast of Africa. These so-called African easterly waves tend to get stronger when they encounter favorable winds and warm water. They tend to dissipate if they hit cool water, disruptive air currents, or dust.
Last year, we saw African easterly waves just get taken apart by dust storms.
Greg Jenkins is a hurricane expert at Howard University. He says dust also seemed to weaken a lot of storms in 2006. But Jenkins says this year, the satellite images are telling a different story.
We don't see any dust, any significant dust. But we do see Josephine, Ike, and we see Hannah.
It's not clear why the amount of dust varies so much from year to year, but Jenkins is one of a growing number of scientists who believe that dust helps explain why some storms become hurricanes and some don't. He says the dust gets swept up into the atmosphere as winds whip across the deserts of northern Africa.
So in the summertime, we see a layer basically about 3 miles up to probably 6-7 miles high, where we see a dust layer. We call it the Saharan air layer.
And it carries a lot of dust, millions of tons each season. For the past few years, scientists have been trying to figure out just what that dust does to baby storms. In 2006, NASA spent a month flying planes near developing storm systems along the African coast. During one of those flights, NASA scientist Robbie Hood described what happened to one of the storm systems she was tracking.
The first day we flew it, it was pretty much clear in the center of it, just normal moisture patterns. The next day we flew it, we got in the center of it, and it was filled with dust.
The storm petered out. That sort of research has added to the evidence that dust tends to tamp down developing storms. Bill Lau, who works at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, has published several studies on dust and storms. He says they all reach the same conclusion.
More dust, less hurricane, and more hurricane, less dust.
But it's not entirely clear why. Lau says one likely reason is that dust particles absorb some of the sun's heat. They also reduce the amount of sunlight that reaches the ocean.
So as a result, the ocean absorbs less heat from the sun, and therefore it has an effect of cooling the ocean.
Meaning less potential energy to fuel a hurricane. And Lau says there's another factor.
Accompanying the dust are always dry air from the Sahara, and hurricane does not like dry air. So both of this effect, the dry air itself and also the blocking of solar radiation, can suppress a hurricane.
Dust researchers say they're not trying to downplay other factors affecting the hurricane season, things like sea surface temperature and the presence of El Niño wind patterns. But they say it may be time to start considering dust when making seasonal forecasts. Greg Jenkins says the lack of dust this year tells him that Josephine won't be the season's last storm.
I'm a little nervous because unless dust really starts to develop or we get some other factors to weaken them, it may be a rough ride in September and in October.
After all, we're still only halfway through the 2008 hurricane season. John Hamilton, NPR News.